I, Charles A. Wolf, W-O-L-F, was born in Columbus, Ohio, August 26, 1900. I enlisted in the service in the band, United States Army Band, in 1919. I was 18 then. And I served one enlistment overseas, and then I came back and got out because I was a telegrapher, and I bummed all around the country as a bum, a telegraph operator. And so I was also in the bands and loved music. And so after a time, the music got the best of my telegraphy, and I returned to the service and went in the bands, and I went to Hawaii in 1931. And I completed 30 years then, when retired. I came up to Alaska after trying and trying and trying for a number of times, but as there's no bands here, I didn't have much of a chance to get here. I think they had a band in Fort Gibbon, which is Tananaw. I think they had a band there one time, but that was discontinued, I think, in about 1922. And then after that was, and then they had a, I was going to say they had a band at Inglewood. I don't believe they did, but they had troops there, you know. I believe it was called Fort Davis, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure about that. And then they had an outfit, only two or three companies of infantry at Chilkoot Barracks. And there was no band there. The regular regimental band for that was down at Vancouver Barracks in Washington. So you see, I just had a heck of a time getting up into Alaska. I one time rode up here, was going to give up my Army work if I could get assurance of a job. And I rode up to Chamber of Commerce here at Anchorage, and I might have rode to Fairbanks too. And I tried to get a job on railroad, because that was government control. But nobody would assure me of a job. So I didn't want to give up my Army service. So then I, when the Air Force came up here, they brought a they have a band up here. And I came up to the Air Force then. Well, I first came to Elmendorf with the Air Force and just served 1 year there. And then I heard about the band leader up here wanting to go back to the States. And so I hot-footed and I just worried everybody until they gave me a transfer up here, because I think myself, this is the real Alaska here in the interior. And I wanted so bad to be here. So I put in one enlistment here at that time, and then they wouldn't let us stay here longer than 3 years, so I returned to the States. And at that time, though, I had 26 years of service, and so they had a law then that if you have 26 years, you can pick your last post for retirement. And so I was only a year in the States, and I was quite flattered that they didn't want to let me come back, but they had to encounter the regulations, so I hot-footed back to land. So I completed my 30 years, and all these many years I've been dreaming and talking to all the old sourdoughs of Alaska that I could get a hold with and get information about the bush. And I've read so much about the Indians all my life, not shoot 'em up cowboy books, but authentic contemporary authors. And so I went on a trap line then, right immediately when I got out, up on the Colleen River. I was up there for 10 years, and I liked it no end. So I also liked to canoe a lot. And I used to leave here about the middle of August, and I'd get back the 1st of June, and I'm married too. And so in addition, I didn't take my wife though, but in addition to that, some summers I'd be gone. Like last summer, I was gone for 90 days. So being up there for 9 months and about 3 months on the canoe, there wasn't much time left, and my wife last year put a foot down. And so then I stayed in this winter, and this is the first winter I've been in town now in 11 years. I guess that just about covers that thing, now, Mr. Luddy?
Yeah.
Okay. I wrote this up because one other time I had tried to do a little talking, and I forget or something leads me astray from lots of things that I like to talk about. I've went over this two or three times, and I've taken out lots of the stuff that I think that would be interesting maybe to some people, but it got a little bit too long. So this is where I have it. My canoe is a 13-foot aluminum double ender. My paddles are single-bladed and reach to my eyes and have a 6 3/4-inch blade. One is made of spruce and the other, an extra one, is made of hardwood like maple. I carry two large sponges to use in getting the water out of my canoe during the rain or when water spills in over the gunwale on running rapids or in rough water and high waves. I attach lining ropes to the bow and stern. I use a 6x8 tarpaulin with sewed flared ends. I liked it very much, but it took 5 poles to put it up, and I had to hang a mosquito net under it to protect me from the mosquitoes. This takes too much time each evening to gather the poles and to put it up. I changed to a miner's tent. In the West, it is called a herder's tent. It is similar to a teepee and goes up with one pole and has a mosquito-proof netting at the door. There are more modern design tents than this that are lighter and quicker to erect. I do not like them for long, extended canoe trips, where one is forced by inclement weather to lay over for a day or more, and when a warming and cooking fire feels so good. With my miner's tent, I can stake out the door flaps and build a fire between them that will heat the inside of my tent. I always carry birch bark to start fires with. It is a big help during the rain when the wood is wet. I use a down sleeping bag and a 3/4 air mattress. I have used evergreens, but this takes too much time. I use a Northwest type pack sack and 2 small waterproof duffel bags. I wear lightweight wool or part wool underclothes. I wear wool oldie, old style army pants. I wear plain Indian tanned and smoked moosehide moccasins with moccasin rubbers. This combination enables one to have dry feet. Just change socks and moccasins and wipe out the rubbers. I take 3 pairs of moccasins as they weigh very little. I carry dry food, not the expensive dehydrated packaged meals, but oats, rice, pilot bread, biscuit flour to bake pancakes, smoked meats like Simmer sausage, hard salami, butter, raisins, dry milk, dry soup, and a few canned things to prepare in a hurry. I like to carry smoked fish and dry meat. Some people call it jerky. Old timers I know call it dry meat. Dry meat does not contain any fat, so it should be spread with butter or bone grease. I might mention right here that bone grease is made from the Indians gather the bones and they crush them. They either beat them with an axe or with a stone, and they put them in a good sized kettle of water and boil them, and then the grease comes to the top and they dip it off, skim it off, and it's real nice and white and clean. And it's just like butter, very sustaining. This dry meat doesn't have any fat, so it should be spread with butter or bone grease. It is a sustaining food and is light and needs no preparation, and a person can do a lot of work on this ration. Eating dry meat is good exercise for the jaws. It has always been difficult to get one's canoe and gear to the starting point and return it from where the paddling stops. The Hudson Bay Company of Canada has solved this problem for Canadians. They have a U-paddle service. A canoe can be rented at one of their stores near the starting point and turned in to the nearest store at the end of the trip. I hope that our pioneer store, the Nolan Commercial Company, will start such a service for Alaskans. They may be able to arrange with the Hudson Bay Company whereby a canoe rented in Canada could be turned in to one of the many Northern commercial stores here in Alaska. Like renting a canoe from the Hudson Bay Company at Whitehorse and turning it in at one of the Northern commercial stores along the Yukon River. On this trip, I found an Army sergeant who was returning to Indiana in a surplus Army passenger bus. He had taken out all the seats to make room for his furniture, which he would bring back to Alaska, where he planned to live after his retirement. We drove down the Alaska Highway some 1,200 miles to Fort Nelson, British Columbia. 3 miles south of here, where a bridge spans the Musqua, which is local Indian for bear, I put my canoe in the water and started my trip back to Alaska by way of the Mackenzie River. I turned my canoe around and sit on the front seat, which is then near the mule. I cut my tent pegs long and used them and my tent pole to place my camping gear on in the canoe to keep them out of the water. This sometimes splashes in and out of the rainwater that collects in the bottom of the canoe. From here to Fort Yukon by way of Aklavik in the Mackenzie River Delta is about 2,000 river miles, about half of which is above the Arctic Circle. With the exception of the short distance up the Peel River and Rat River, this entire trip is downstream. The only portages are at the head of the Rat and McDougal's Pass, all of which are short. Paddling away from the bridge, it is but a short distance to the Fort Nelson River. In the early summer, most northern rivers are fast and muddy. It is about 100 miles to the Liard River. Approaching the Liard River from the Fort Nelson avoids the dangerous 40-mile canyon and grueling 4-mile portage over a 1,000-foot mountain spur on the upper Liard. One trip, a cow, moose, and half-calf came down the bank and swam the river in front of me. She scented me, but as I remained perfectly quiet and drifted with the current, the same as a piece of drift, she did not associate me with the scent. It has been my experience that more game is seen along the small streams than the larger ones. There are many, many Indian camping places along the Fort Nelson and Liard, and if one watches closely, he can spot them. Saplings that have been cut and trimmed and used as tent poles, some stuck at angles into the ground. A slight clearing or a path up the bank will denote the camping site. The Liard has a fast current and is a pleasant river for the paddle canoeer to travel on. I saw a lightning and thunderstorm in the distance, and as I was close to a cabin just ahead of me, decided to wait there until it passed. Securing my canoe to the bank, I walked up the ramp cut in the dirt bank. The door was partly ajar, and as I walked into the center of the almost empty cabin, I heard a slight noise behind me. I looked around and saw a small blue-eyed sled dog lying behind the door. He was thumping his tail on the floor and talking to me with his eyes, but he made no other move. As I went closer, I could smell decayed flesh. Returning to my canoe, I got some dry meat and grease for him. He thanked me for it. The storm bypassed me, so I moved on. Sometime later, I thought about the dog, and only then, when it was too late, I remembered that I had forgotten to give him some water. I had not thought about a broken leg at the time, nor could I have shot the dog, as I did not carry a gun. Some Indians I know will not shoot a wolf or a dog, and I don't like to either. At Fort Liard, on a prior trip, I heard about two experienced young men canoeists. who paddled too close to a large barge that is tied to the bank. When they got really too close to the barge, they made almost a right angle to turn their canoe into the bank. The swift current swept them under the outside end of the barge. Most everything was recovered, and as all equipment was in waterproof bags, were not damaged. As this happened right in front of the village, before an audience, their dignity suffered a severe blow. It is remarkable sometimes what a mess experienced canoeists can get into. I know a lady canoeist who, paddling up against a fast current, passed a fish wheel and immediately turned her canoe at right angles to the current, intending to land, and was almost swept into it. She was a large and strong girl, and her strength with the paddle saved her from a very embarrassing situation. There is a rock in the Porcupine River near the mouth of the Colleen. I have passed it for the last 10 years. One time, right after breakup on a cold, miserable day, I was all wrapped up and had a parka hood over my head and forgot about the rock. I was caught in a whirlpool and hit the rock with such force that it bent up the metal rib and knocked one of my three sled dogs into the swirling water. I managed to get out of this and save my dogs. When I got the dog into my canoe, it was several minutes before she was warm enough to shake the water out of her long fur coat. If I had been thrown into the water, I would have certainly sank to the bottom in minutes, with all those wool clothes I had on, and the just above freezing water would have quickly taken my strength away. I make a practice of reporting to each Royal Canadian Mounted Police post en route on my canoe trips. I think it is the proper thing to do. In case of an accident, it narrows the search area and saves the government both time and money. Two, it is a source of information, and it is the foolish person who does not avail himself of this opportunity. There is a trading post in the south, in the mouth of the South Nahanni, owned by Dick Turner and his wife. 300 miles up this fabled river is beautiful Virginia Falls. This is about a three-day trip by boat with kicker. Myths about this little-known valley has been circulating for years. I'm sure there are a lot of people, perhaps right now, that have heard about all those stories that about the South Nahanni River. They call it a tropical paradise, and that they were almost palm trees up there, and all that sort of stories. There is a splendid book entitled The Dangerous River by Raymond Patterson. It not only tells its history, but tells just where the dangerous rapids are and how to get around them. It is a must for a person traveling on this river. Other old timers on this river are Gus Krause and Albert Fayley. Dick Turner's son, Don, is a big game guide and takes hunters into this fabulous hunting area. I cut some of the things out of here because my wife said it was getting too long. But I'd like to take just a second here and tell you a story about wolves. Lots of us are interested in wolves, and even this one trapper here, my neighbor, wrote in a story. Even housewives sometimes make comment in the paper about wolves, so everybody, a lot of people are really interested in them. When I talked to Gus, I asked him if he thought that it was that if he knew of any true story or knew of a person at first hand or knew about them that was attacked and killed by a wolf. And he said no, he didn't know about that. And I told him that I've read extensively about wolves, and I have never either. And I thought that was a little unusual that we couldn't hear something about that. So I asked Gus, and he said, well, there was nobody around to tell the story. And I thought that was a pretty good answer. One other thing he mentioned about walls, he told me that in his experiences with wolves and game, he told me that the wolf pack would chase the moose until it was winded, and it would stop, and then the wolves would jump in and harass the wolf, or the moose, and the moose would stay in this just as long as he could, and so they'd run again. Again, the wolves would catch up with them and surround them and start harassing them again. And this happened two, three times, and he said he knew that because he could see each place would be all dug up in the snow where the wolves attacked the moose. And so after they do that for a length of time, why, the moose would just completely wore out. And then the boldest and the most experienced one of the wolf jumps in there and grabs a hold of the flank and rips it open, and the intestines fall out. I'm writing a story about now, and I make a comment of my own right there, and I say that this is the way of life. I add that to it. At this mouth of South Nahai, I met a young German couple, journalist and photographer, who were collecting material for a German-Swiss television company. They were traveling in two German-made kayaks and were on their way to Inuvik and planned to fly up the Rat to the summit and on to Fort Yukon. Right behind them was a party of modern-day voyageurs and two large canoes patterned after the early fur trading canoe, like in that picture there, only not that large. These were seven boys with their teachers in each canoe from Brentwood College, British Columbia. They came with their canoes by school bus to Fort Nelson. After returning from a trip up the Nahanni, they would paddle to the Mackenzie, then paddle where they could and line the rest of the way up the Mackenzie to Fort Providence. The school bus would meet them there and would return them and the canoes to their home. They would have traveled 4,500 miles by canoe and bus. By the way, this these boys, their teacher wore one of these sashes. This is a famous early days canoe sash. They're still being made and still being, there are different types of them. And some are wider and some are longer than others, and some I see have beadwork into them. And some ladies buy these things and put them on their evening gowns, and they make quite a piece of conversation. They're very pretty. They're still being made around Quebec. About 40 miles from the Mackenzie River, there are 17 miles of fast water and rapids in a limestone formation at right angles to the current. They come right straight across the current from bank to bank. The local people call it the Beaver Dam. Going over it, the water forms a chute or falls, and the height of the falls is determined by the stage of water. One time in low water, I thought there was a drop of about 4 feet, and I was quite concerned when I landed at the bottom. The canoe turned around immediately, and I was too close to a number of logs that were being forced up and down a steep rock. I managed to turn around as quick as I could and get out of there. An Indian told me at Fort Liard to pass through this fast water and rapids and over the Beaver Dam at arm's length from the bank. Years ago, the ice took out a large chunk of this limestone formation near the left bank, and motored watercraft can pass through this opening, but must immediately return to the right bank. There just might be some people that don't know just when a person retires to the right and left bank of a river. Facing downstream, the bank on your right is right bank, and the bank on your left is left bank. So I usually say right bank here. So now you know that when I say the right bank will be downstream. Although when a person asks for information along the rivers, it's mighty good policy to say to them, a right bank going up or a right bank going down, or so you'll be sure that you know just which bank it referred to. It can be a dangerous business if the boat does not leave the bank at the right place and time, or should they have motor failure. Next day I saw a boat that had filled overnight. The boat was tied with bow and stern lines to the bank when the owners camped. During the night, the river fell several feet, and the boat rested on the bottom of the river. The water was just under the gunwales, but through a deep opening in the stern where the motor was attached, the water poured into the boat and rode 4 tons of cement. You probably saw where boats are cut down in the back, you know. It's down below the gunwale. That's because I think sometimes the shaft doesn't reach down below the bottom of the boat. That is, if it was right level on the bottom, the shaft wouldn't be long enough, so they cut this big hole. Well, if they hadn't have done it, of course, they wouldn't have ruined their 4 tons of cement. These were two young men, one an Indian and the other a white boy. They were taking the cement to Fort Liard. I offered to help, but they did not seem to worry much about it, saying they would rest a while and return to Simpson for another load. The cement was government-owned. When I tied up at the Royal Canadian Mounted Police dock, three young men were leaving for Nunavut. Once before, when I was here, an American boy and his partner and two girl hitchhikers were en route to Iqaluit. These girls, like many boys and a few girls, got the urge to go down north, so purchased a light backpacking outfit and hitchhiked to Hay River. At that time, Hay River was the end of the Mackenzie River Highway, but now it has been extended around the west end of Great Slave River and has ferries over the Mackenzie and goes to Yellowknife. Fort Simpson, I wrote quite a little bit about those girls, but like I say, my wife told me I was getting it too long. So, I've always been allergic to girls, I guess that's why. Fort Simpson has a hospital, a Roman Catholic and Anglican hostel for school children, two stores, a few automobiles, and a population of about 1,000. The Mackenzie is a clear water river until the Muddy Liard enters it. The muddy water and the clear water run side by side for about 150 miles before the Mackenzie is muddied from bank to bank. Traveling the Mackenzie in late June and early July can be very hot. I figured one time I thrice burnt the skin off my face and neck. Tugboats shoving as high as 10 barges operate on the river. Two of these covered barges hold over 500 tons. I made the comment here that I had never seen any pictures of such a big number of barges being shoved on Yukon as I saw on the Mackenzie. But afterwards, I got to thinking that on the Mackenzie, the big major load goes down, and on the Yukon, why, it's just opposite and it goes up. So that probably accounts for that. Two of these covered barges hold over 500 tons. Just above Fort Norman, one can see red bands in the bank. This is where a low grade of coal has burned out. Alexander Mackenzie reported the banks on fire when he passed here in 1789. It is interesting to note here that Eric W. Morris, a Canadian voyageur, a current one, has mapped out a canoe trip and has passed over it from Chesterfield Inlet on Hudson Bay to the mouth of Yukon. It passes down the Great Bear River. This Bear River is about 80 miles long and goes to Great Bear Lake, and Great Bear Lake is about the fourth, I think, largest lake in North America. It ranks just ahead of Lake Erie. And it was also the place where the pitch bend was taken out of, and from which the very first atomic bomb was exploded. On a prior trip, I met Father Cody here, who drew me a rough map of the canoe passage through the Sansu Rapids. A great hazard of the Mackenzie for a paddle canoe is a north wind. One must be careful to not make long crossings if there is any chance of getting caught out in the middle during a blow. Everybody knows that did any boating and canoeing on the rivers that the current doesn't just go right along one side of the bank. It's crossing over back and forth from one side to another quite frequently, and any kind of, and that's where the fast water is. So a person in the canoe then, that's advantage to him then to follow the current. But still, on a great big river, it's a little bit of have to be a little bit careful, because if he gets caught out in the middle, and in some places like in Norman Wells, where it's 4 miles wide, you have 2 miles to go if you get caught in a heavy wind there. And so that's what I mean by that. You have to be very careful and try to read the weather and not make these great big crossings. One such crossing has taught me a lesson to be extra careful of the weather when crossing large bodies of water. Norman Wells is below Fort Norman and is the only package store. I thought some people would be interested in that. Norman Wells is below Fort Norman and is the only package store on the river, and quite possibly one of only several in the Northwest Territories. I bet a lot of people here will remember about the Canal pipeline that they made from there. That was one of the great fiascos, so to say, of the American Army. I forget how many millions and millions and millions of dollars are wasted with that. They couldn't be used for civilian use either. One big reason for it was the pipe was too small for any amount of oil to be pumped through it. That is a oil country there at Norman Wells. So they couldn't use it either. So millions of dollars were wasted there. The canoe passage that I'm talking of, the Sansu, below here is the Sansu Rapids. The canoe passage is along the left bank. A life was lost here recently when a canoeist tried to pass through the rapids along the right bank. Or he may have waited too long before crossing to the left bank, and so was too close to the rapids, or rather too close to the rapids, and was swept by the current over the ledge and capsized and drowned. These rapids really don't amount to anything, and that goes for lots of rapids. The old early day canoeists had a name for the passage in any rapids that was runnable. Some rapids you just can't run. You just can't go through certain rapids. But rapids that they can pass through, there is one passage that the person should take. And the old time, like I say, in the early days, the French voyageurs even had a name for that passage. And so that's what I mean about going through some of these packages. The passage, like, for instance, on the Five Fingers and the Yukon, it really don't amount to anything. But, of course, a person must remember, though, that on the Yukon, all the many, many hazards that the early day sourdoughs had have been removed. And so that's what I mean about the rapids. Some of them cannot be run, but all the ones that can be run, there's a particular place where you should go through. And if you know that particular place, with common sense and a little experience, why, you don't have no trouble. just above Fort Good Hope, this is the next village below Norman Wells. Just above Fort Good Hope is the picturesque upper ramparts of the Mackenzie, which extend for about 7 miles. It is a limestone formation, and the banks go up from 100 to 150 feet. It's a narrowing down of the river there. The entrance is along the right bank. Father Robin, who was stationed there for over 40 years, told me that when the Indians saw me paddling in the distance, they knew immediately that I was a white man. As no Indian was so poor, he could not afford a motor. There's a very interesting church here, a Catholic church. It's just completely painted on the inside and has many oil paintings too on the inside. And it was painted with the very crudest of paint. I think the people told me that they even used some oil from the fish in order to mix the paints. And some of the oils are done by the fathers. One in particular I noticed, well, I noticed them all, of course, but a couple of them there have been placed there recently by Father Brown. Some of the people here might know about a dog magazine that's published in Seattle. I think it's called Arctic Dogs. This Father Brown, he wrote a couple letters to this magazine, and he likes to raise sled dogs. But he's stationed on the on a lake there. I think it's called Colville, about 100 miles or so. And he likes to raise dogs, but he also has a very profitable fish camp. And people fly in there from the United States. And I might mention, too, here, that people from the United States fly all the way to Great Bear Lake just to go fishing. Isn't that remarkable how person can really like his sport that much? Of course, he has to be rich too, no doubt. The church here is something to see. Being painted inside, and many oil paintings hang on the wall. I wanted Mr. Crum right there to note this little thing here about forest fires. When leaving the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, I saw a forest fire sign on the wall, written in English and Indian syllabic characters. This is a system of writing invented by Reverend James in 1840 for the Crees. The Indians called it the talking bark. It was the Cree language could use just a very small, and it covered all their language. But for many of the others, like the Chiprians, why they had to add many to it, but it had been throughout the North, and I think even Eskimos might have that syllabic writing. Maybe those ladies there might bear me out in that. Can you remember syllabic characters in old church books? Uh-huh. I know that up at Old Crow there was Archdeacon MacDonald who used those characters to translate the Book of Prayer and also parts of the Bible. And they still use them for Yukon and also along the Mackenzie. The Indians call it the talking bark. About 9 miles below here, one crosses the Arctic Circle. The next village is Arctic Red River, which is just in the mouth of the Red River. Below here at Point Separation, I headed towards the mouth of the Peel River. This is just a short paddle trip from Point Separation there. This is named, by the way, by two early day cartographers, I guess is the right word, mappers, people who make maps. They separated there. One went by the west channel out into the Arctic and mapped the coastline all the way to Barrow, and the other one went out the east way at the mouth of the Mackenzie and mapped, I think, all the way around to about the mouth of the Coppermine River, and that's why they call it separation. From point separation then to the mouth of the Pewee, not a very much of a paddle. There is Indian camp here, and I have always hired an Indian. I say always hired because I made this trip three times now. I've always hired an Indian with boat and kicker to take me up the 28 miles to Fort McPherson. That's where I learned about the bone grease. There's a man there by the name of George Victor. He was a brother to my very good friend, who I like to call my Indian brother, William Victor. And he was very nice to me. He gave me some of this bone grease, and he gave me a lot of dry meat, and he also gave me some dried fish. And that's why I learned how nice they are, and they don't take up much room. And they're very sustaining. He took me with his kicker the 28 mile to Fort McPherson. I had planned to get my old friend William Victor, a Luchu, to help me up the raft, but this time he did not want to go, saying he did not like the long, difficult walk back. Other Indians did not want to go either for any amount of money, and they discouraged me from going, saying I would run out of water. One pilot flying over the area said he thought at some places on the rat there was not enough water to float a fish, but he was sure wrong. So I decided to paddle to a Klavik and try to contact the German couple, and we would share a charter and fly up to the summit. The Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman suggested I paddle down the Husky Channel, saying I would have less trouble with the wind, which I did. The Husky Channel has many bends and high mud banks, and camping places are hard to find. When I passed the north branch of the Rat River, it has two outlets. One of them is just off the Peel River, but it just winds all around every place. But the north branch, where I stopped here, was a branch that the early day Sardo used, and A.B. Davis, I'm sure, and others will remember Mr. Henry Appel. Mr. Henry Appel came up this way. I might stop just for a second right here and tell you something interesting, I thought. In 1897, there was a newspaper article in a Chicago newspaper that mentioned for the sum of $500, they would guarantee to take a person and land them on the Klondike in 6 weeks and furnish them grub for 1 year. This lady's name was Craig. She's an old pioneer lady. Later, her name now, maybe Mrs. Rushton might know her, is Mrs. Romig, R-O-M-I-G. I think her granddaughter was in town here just a few days ago. Well, this lady was a Danish American.
Mrs.
Daly.
Yeah, it's the second Mrs.
Daly. Oh. Well, she was a Danish girl, and I think she was 28 at the time in Chicago. But just imagine, these two, and another thing, what they guaranteed food for 1 year, and they guaranteed to land them people 6 weeks, mind you, by way of the Mackenzie on the Klondike. And they also said that one of them had been over the trail before. Well, none of them had ever been out of Chicago. And all the people who were coming to the mine, they didn't know anything either about mining. And really, for a person that reads back on all these mishaps that they had in the early days, they'll finally agree that lots of them, that was the reason for them. They didn't know nothing at all what they were getting into. To begin with, those people left Chicago in late August. Imagine that now. But they managed to get as far as Fort Resolution, which is just west of the mouth of the Slave River, which goes into Great Slave Lake. And they wintered there. And there, Mrs. Craig and her husband received an education and how to live in a North country, which later might have really saved their lives. He was a ship's carpenter, and he learned how to drive dogs and how to make toboggans, and his wife learned how to cook native food so he wouldn't get the scurvy. And so they spent the next summer then, and they got as far as this north branch of the raft. And they go up the north branch because they can use the motor there for around 25 miles or so before you actually start wading, you know, and lining your canoe. And this was a place at that time called Destruction City. And that's where they wintered, and that's where Mr. Appel wintered. Well, when this lady got there, why, lots of the people just ate salt stuff, dried salted meat, and they got the scurvy.
What year?
It was about she started in 1897, but I think it was 1898 when they wintered at, no, it would be 1899, I believe, because the first winter they spent at Fort Resolution, and the next winter at Destruction City. And they got its name there because they could take their good-sized boats that far, and then they either tore them down and used them and helped building their cabin, or they made toboggans out of them. And then in the spring, before the breakup, why, then that's when they went up over the raft. I thought I'd mention that. When I passed the north branch of the raft, I was surprised to find a fair stage of water. And if I had not told the policeman that it would go to a Klavik, I would have surely went up the rat originally planned. I was really disappointed. William and I have paddled up this branch of the rat and also from the south branch to Destruction City. This is where the wading starts. The other times when we went, he took his small canoe, and we took this roundabout way because it's easy of paddling. There wasn't a strong current. And he left his canoe there, and he walked back to Destruction City. But I might mention this a little bit later on here about portage. Excuse me. Most gold rushers wintered here and went up over the ice just before the breakup. Going back to that story about Mrs. Craig, if I don't bore you, they said, that, you know, remember, that they would get them there and guarantee to get them there within 6 weeks. Well, they was 2 years on the trail. My friend, here I mentioned this, my friend in Fairbanks, Mr. Henry Pell, came up this way. My good neighbor and friend Elkan and Ann Morris, who lives right down close to me on Louise Street, came up the Rat River in a canoe on their long paddle trip from New York City to Fort Yukon. Now there's a person you ought to have up here instead of me. It is about 45 miles from Destruction City to McDougal's Pass. We made it up one time in 6.5 days. But 10 days is about the best number of days to spend on it. At 6.5, you really got to hump it there. I was in the service that time and on furlough, and so I had to make time. There are several short portages there, but the longest is about a mile or less. I paddled on down the Husky Channel then to the Peel Channel, and just below here is a Klavik. Some people here remember, too, this just a number of years ago, that they said that the Klavik was going to sink into the silt there. And so then they decided on another firmer town site and did build a town there, and they called it Inuvik. By the way, Inuvik means the place of the white man, and the Klavik means the brown bear swimming across. Am I right about that? Or close, huh? That's the Eskimo.
Are these girls from that country?
They're from Barrow.
Oh, from Barrow.
Oh, Barter Island. I was able to contact the German people, and we shared a charter to Summit Lake. The Indians call this Loon Lake, but on the map, it's called Summit Lake. An Eskimo pilot named Gordon, did I strike a bell? An Eskimo pilot named Gordon took us up in about 30 minutes. We portaged from the lake to the Little Bell. It is a picturesque small little creek with high banks and a fair current, with plenty of water to float our canoes. As it nears the larger Bell, it has a number of rock-filled shallow rapids. I waded most of these, but the Germans ran or tried to run them all, bumping and thumping on the rocks. In the early days, when the way I've read, if a canoe has hit a rock, that is, must have been an accident, some of them you couldn't speak to them for 2 or 3 days. They just thought that'd be terrible to go bumping and thumping along. But they took that as old hat with them. That seems the way they run rapids over in Germany, I guess. Elmer hit a rock, which made a small hole in his kayak and caused him trouble for the balance of the trip. Little Bridget was an excellent rapid runner. The Bell River has a very slow current. Vladimir Stephenson thought it was extremely slow. However, he walked over the 80-mile portage from McPherson to Lapeer House on the Bell, where he built a log raft and floated to Old Crow. Such a clumsy conveyance as a raft of logs, which is hard to maneuver, is truly a very slow way to travel a slow current. So no wonder he thought it was slow. That's right. He went over a current there, I believe, wasn't it? Was it night? And,
no, he just got disgusted at first.
He wanted to walk along the bank.
He said, I could do better than that. He got out and hit those
big heads
and got
right
back.
By the way, if a person wants to check up on that, I think the book is Great Hunters of the North, or Great Hunters of the North, I believe it is. That was just a terrible portage, but that was used all them many years, though. It was used to supply Fort Yukon, which was the Hudson Bay was there for 22 years. It was built in 1847 by Alexander Hunter Murray. I say 22 years, and somebody might be checking up on me for that, because we bought it in 1867. But it was 2 years afterwards when they moved. And as you all know, they moved up to mouth of the Salmon Trout River, and then again they were told they were on American soil, so they moved again. But they waited this time until the survey was made at Rapid House, so they'd be sure the next move they made would be on Canadian soil. So that's where they moved to lately. But they did use that portage for all that time. It was a terrible portage. One end of it, they had to lead the dogs and sled down with a rope. And the first part of it, about 4 or 5 miles, was in the spring would be flooded, and there was waded through water a good portion of it. And it's also over Niggerhead. 80. Yeah, 80 miles.
That was on the Bell River?
It's from McPherson overland to the Bell River, Lapeer House.
They didn't
use a canoe, they just walked. That's right. The packages in the early days in Hudson Bay Company were made up into 90 pounds, but that was just a little bit heavy. And so later they were made 80 pounds. But anybody that carried Hudson Bay goods across that portage, it had to carry at least one of those packages. And some of them could carry two. And that weight doesn't include what they're going to eat and what they're going to keep warm at night. So anything in addition to those packages, they had to be extra. Them. And imagine walking over those niggerheads. It was a terrible 80-mile portage, not just for the distance, but the atrocious walking in the summer, and even in winter, when one place called the chutes, the dogs and toboggans had to be let down with a rope. On the Bell, we saw moose, bear, wolf, and caribou. and a few ducks and geese. We were too late for the rafts of young geese I have seen on early trips down the barrel. It is a beautiful, scenic trip through the mountains, and Elmer and Bridget took many pictures. I consider myself a fair paddler in a canoe, but I found out that a canoe does not have a chance with a kayak. Little Bridget and Elmer, seemingly with little effort, could keep ahead of me and waited many times for me to catch up. They used a double paddle. The kayak sits low in the water, thus having very little wind resistance. However, they are not recommended for long wilderness travels where one has many portages. The trip down the Porcupine from Oak Crow is one of the prettiest and enjoyable trips I know. This is also the opinion of other widely traveled canoeists. The upper ramparts start above New Rampart House and extend to near Canyon Village, which is just below the rock called the Howling Dog. About 5 miles above Burnt Paw is the Colleen River that enters on the right bank. I have lined up this river about 75 miles to my trapping cabin for the last 10 years. Only twice during that time could I use my motor. I used a 19-foot aluminum canoe for this and a 7.5 motor. It takes me about 8 days to line up this river. My 3 sled dogs run along the bank. The Colleen is a swift, shallow mountain stream. The old name for it is the Sucker River. I've tried to find out how it got its name, but the closest I could find out was in 1897, Coast Geodetic had a survey party up through there, and they named the mountain. But there's no mention about the river, so I just presume that after they named the mountain, why, then they changed that to the Colleen. But I kind of thought myself, too, that perhaps in that party that one of them might have been an Irishman and thinking of his pretty Colleen back in Ireland. Perhaps 5 people have lived on the Colleen for any length of time. I got this information from the man I bought the trap line from, Mr. Ed Owens, who is well into his 80s now and who is still up there. He's been up there now, I presume, for about 50 years. He raised a family up there. There's either 4 or 5 girls. And he likes to be known as a prospector, but he's also an excellent trapper and an excellent riverman. He came into that country from Rampart House, New Rampart House. At that time, after Hudson Bay quit there was a old Scotsman by the name of Daniel Cadzo. He run it for a good many years, and he influenced Mr. Ed Owens to go in there, and Mr. Ed Owens went in there by dog team in the winter, and he went and wintered for several seasons on Strangle Woman Creek. That's above where my cabin is. By the way, there's a gentleman, Mr. Lardy, that you ought to get on this this program. He's a real old sourdough. I'm just a imitation sourdough. There's perhaps 5 people that have lived on this river for any length of time. Mr. Ed Owens, from whom I purchased his trap line, have lived on this river for close to 50 years and raised a family there, and still, 1968, lives there. He, for a short time, had a trading post, and the inland Eskimos who live at Anaktuvik Pass came there to do their trading. Daniel Cadzo, the old Scott trader, I'm repeating myself now, sorry. Daniel Cadzo, the old Scotch trader at New Rampart House, suggested he go into that part of the country to trap, which he did, moving in by dog team to Strangle Woman Creek. Joe Ward,